The Republic of Pirates by Colin Woodard, continued. Disc 3.
During the War of Spanish Succession, Jamaica's planters had reason to worry about a Spanish or French invasion. With most of its warships tied up protecting the English Channel or convoying merchantmen, England's Royal Navy could spare few resources to defend its scattered Caribbean colonies. For most of the war, the Leeward Islands colony, St. Christopher, Nevis, Antigua, and Montserrat, was protected by a single fifth-rate frigate, and for long periods had no naval protection at all. Barbados, located dangerously close to the French colonies of Martinique and Guadeloupe, had only a fourth and fifth rate in the best of times. The Bahamian settlements had no protection at all, and were repeatedly burned by French and Spanish invaders. Even Jamaica, the Navy's regional headquarters, generally had only a half dozen warships on station, and rarely were these larger than a fourth rate. Nor could the frigates stationed at the various colonies help one another effectively. Simply getting from one place to another could be next to impossible. The square-rigged warships of the day could not sail into the wind any closer than 68 degrees, and with the wind and waves pushing the ships away from their destination, might make little or no progress at all. Since the trade winds blew from the east, it was very easy for ships to sail from, say, Barbados or the Leeward Islands to Jamaica with the wind at their backs, which was the direction all incoming trips from Europe sailed. Sailing from Jamaica toward Barbados, on the other hand, was extremely difficult, which is why ships bound for Europe sailed up the Atlantic seaboard in the Gulf Stream instead, eventually catching prevailing easterlies back across the North Atlantic. Were Barbados to come under attack, there was little hope of anyone in Jamaica helping them. Smaller, more nimble sloops and schooners could sail closer into the wind and carry messages back and forth between islands, but even that could take weeks, so each colony's naval detachment was usually on its own. The warships were, in any case, rarely in any condition to sail, let alone engage an enemy. The tropical climate rotted the sails and rigging, and corroded fittings and anchors, none of which could be easily replaced in the West Indies. If a mainmast were lost in a lightning storm or battle, the ship would have to sail all the way to New England for a replacement, there being no suitable trees left in the islands. Worse yet, the sea itself was home to shipworm, a ravenous, wood-eating parasite that would bore through the warship's oaken hulls, causing them to leak. The only effective means of fighting the parasite was to careen the ship every 3 months, emptying the entire vessel and in shallow water turning it first on one side, then the other, scraping and cleaning all the parasites and bottom growth that had accumulated there. Smaller vessels could do this on a gradually sloping beach, but the larger ones, like Navy frigates, required some sort of base against which to rest the ship, a specially constructed wharf, or the hulk of an old ship, for instance, which were generally unavailable in the islands. As a result, when the Jamaican squadron attempted to sail out of Port Royal in 1704 to beat off a rumored French attack, the 20-gun 6th-rate HMS Seahorse was so leaky she had to immediately return to harbor. The 5th-rate Experiment was judged unseaworthy, and 2 Jamaican support ships were judged too structurally unsound to go into combat. In 1711, the governor of the Leeward Islands reported that the sole station ship there was so foul, her sails and riggings much worn, in short, everything so out of order for want of stores, that should she go to leeward to protect a convoy of outgoing merchantmen, it would be impossible for her to turn to the windward again, and she would be obliged to go either for Jamaica or New England. The crews were often in worse shape than the ships. Men already suffering from a poor diet, harsh discipline, exposure, and disease had difficulty acclimatizing themselves to the heat and humidity of the Caribbean. It didn't help that they wore woolen clothes and subsisted on salted meats, heavy biscuits, and large quantities of beer and rum. Once exposed to the diseases of the tropics, malaria and yellow fever, smallpox and leprosy, the sailors began dropping like flies. Commodore William Carr, the commander at Jamaica in 1706, had lost so many men to disease he was unable to leave Port Royal's harbor to carry out a planned attack on the annual Spanish treasure fleet. In the months that followed, the English fleet ran out of food and was unable to procure sufficient provisions from the Jamaicans, who, like other English colonists, refused to grow or eat tropical produce, relying instead on imported flour and salt meats from England or North America. By the time Carr's official supply arrived in July 1707, most of his men were dead, and he had to take large numbers of men from the newly arrived ships just to make it home. Even when operative, the warships couldn't contend with the nimble French privateers swarming across the Caribbean from Martinique and Guadeloupe. Privateers used swift sloops and two-masted brigantines that could sail much closer into the wind than a square rigger. Captain Charles Constable, stationed at Barbados in 1711, warned its governor that the French privateers sailed so very well that it was usually impossible for any man of war to catch them. Upon seeing any man of war, they only stretch farther to windward and continue cruising for our merchant vessels, and often do take them. The governor, he suggested, needed to get himself an extraordinary sailing sloop that could challenge the privateers. The English needed to fight fire with fire, and the merchants of Jamaica were eager to do just that. Privateering had a long history in Port Royal. In the 1660s and 1670s, Henry Morgan and other buccaneers raided Spanish shipping under commissions from the governor of Jamaica. The privateers captured hundreds of Spanish ships, bringing them into Port Royal to be condemned by the Vice Admiralty Court as legal prizes of war. The buccaneers surrendered 10% of the prize's value to the Admiralty, which was a small impediment to amassing incredible wealth. Individual buccaneers were said to have spent 2,000 to 3,000 pieces of eight, 500 to 750 pounds, in a single binge. While the buccaneers had faded away in the intervening decades, the Jamaican merchants were well aware of just how profitable privateering could be. They began fitting out privateering vessels as soon as they knew their nation was at war. In the summer of 1702, nine such vessels sailed from Jamaica for the Spanish Main, with more than 500 men aboard. They returned to Jamaica the following spring, their ships laden with slaves, silver, gold dust, and other precious goods, having burnt and plundered several Spanish settlements in Panama and Trinidad. In 1704, a Jamaican privateer defeated a 24-gun French ship, and in conjunction with Royal Navy frigates, began clearing the shipping lanes of enemy privateers. As the war progressed, the Jamaican privateer fleet grew to 30 vessels, carrying between 70 and 150 men each, the equivalent of three-fourths of the island's white male population. The people of this island were intent on nothing so much as encouraging the privateers, and though they sometimes suffered considerable losses, the many rich prizes that were daily brought in made a sufficient return, a resident recalled a quarter century later. Edward Thatch served aboard one of these privateering vessels, which cruised the waters around nearby Cuba and Hispaniola, an island now split between the nations of Haiti and the Dominican Republic, attacking poorly defended Spanish merchantmen. Occasionally, they cruised in the Leeward Islands, in the Straits of Florida, or off Veracruz and other parts of the Spanish Main. In his years of service aboard the privateers, Thatch never made captain, though he probably rose to a skilled position such as mate, the captain's chief lieutenant, quartermaster, in charge of ship's operations, bosun, commanding landing parties, or gunner. He certainly learned his way around the Caribbean, how to sail the treacherous, unmarked passages between islands, where to find hidden anchorages from which one could hunt for food, water, a good beach to careen a sloop's hull, and most important, where to find and catch richly laden prizes. Meanwhile, on the other side of the Atlantic, Woods Rogers had also turned to privateering. The merchants of Bristol were losing large numbers of vessels to French privateers. Many wanted both revenge and a chance to recover some of their losses. Dozens applied for commissions to fit out privateering vessels, or at the very least, to let them keep any prizes their armed merchantmen happened to take in their travels. The applications found a receptive audience in London. Queen Anne was sufficiently concerned about the loss of shipping to issue a 1708 decree revoking the Admiralty's share of the prize money. Henceforth, the privateers' owners and crew could divide all the spoils among themselves. Privateering commissions, or letters of marque, were granted to 127 Bristol vessels during the war, including at least four partially owned by Rogers. Rogers was an active slave trader throughout his life, and his earliest privateering venture was no exception. He received his first commission for the 130-ton Whetstone Galley, which he co-owned with three Bristol merchants. While she carried 16 cannon, the vessel Rogers named for his father-in-law was not a private warship per se, but rather an armed slave ship. Bristol customs records show the Whetstone Galley leaving that city on February 3, 1708, bound for the slave coast of Africa, with 1,000 pounds worth of trade goods. On arrival in Guinea, Captain Thomas Robbins was to use the goods to buy 270 slaves and then carry them to Jamaica to be sold. He never made it to Africa. On the way out of England, the Whetstone Galley was captured by French privateers. In March 1707, Rogers received letters of marque for the Eugene Prize, an outright privateer that he co-owned with another merchant. This 100-ton vessel carried 8 guns and 20 well-armed men, and apparently cruised close to home. Rogers had provided only one ball for each of the Eugene Prize's cannon. The next privateers he would invest in would cruise farther afield. Rogers spent the early years of the war in Bristol, starting a family and managing his growing business. At the end of 1707, he received a visitor, one of his father's old friends, the navigator William Dampier. Dampier had left Bristol 4.5 years earlier at the start of the war on a most daring and unusual privateering mission to the Pacific Ocean. He had come to Bristol in the hopes of convincing merchants to bankroll another such mission. The 51-year-old sea captain would have been upset to learn of the elder Woods Rogers' death, but found an even more capable backer in his son. For most English merchants, the Pacific Ocean was still terra incognita. Spain monopolized all European trade on this vast ocean, having colonized the Philippines, Guam, and the entire Pacific coast of the Americas, from the glaciated fjords of southern Chile to the arid missionary pueblos of Nuestra Señora de Loreto on the Baja Peninsula. The Spanish considered their Pacific holdings to be safe from attack, particularly from the east, where ships could access it only by braving the horrific conditions in the Drake Passage at the southern tip of South America, home to the world's most frequent and ferocious storms. Englishmen agreed, calling the Pacific the Spanish Lake. Dampier knew this was not entirely true. He had sailed around the world 3 times, twice via the Drake Passage, plundering towns in Panama and Peru, and as captain of the HMS Roebuck, exploring Australia and New Guinea. Great riches, Dampier knew, awaited those who found a way into the Spanish Lake. The Spanish Empire was fueled by the gold and silver mines of Mexico and Peru, where armies of enslaved Indians were worked to death. The Peruvian Silver Mountain at Potosí alone produced 2 million pesos, 500,000 pounds worth of that precious metal each year, and the other gold and silver mines of Mexico and Peru added another 8.7 million, 2,175,000 pounds. There was little to buy in the New World, so all those riches had to be shipped to Spain, thus the need for the great treasure fleets. By the time of the War of Spanish Succession, Spain had 3 treasure fleets in all. The first 2 sailed across the Atlantic every year or so from Cadiz, Spain, their holds filled with the soldiers, weapons, wines, mining equipment, and manufactured goods needed in their American colonies. One, the Tierra Firma, or mainland fleet, sailed to Cartagena, in what is now Colombia, where it exchanged its cargo for millions of pesos worth of Potosí silver. The other, the New Spain fleet, made for Veracruz, Mexico, where it loaded gold and silver from the mines of Mexico and the cargoes brought in from the Third Fleet. This latter fleet sailed across the Pacific from Acapulco on Mexico's Pacific coast to Manila in the Philippines, 9,000 miles away, carrying silver and gold. There, the captains of these Manila galleons, normally only 1 or 2, bought huge quantities of silks, porcelain, and other high-end products from Asian merchants. The galleons then turned around, carrying these luxuries back across the Pacific to Acapulco. These goods were transported across Mexico to Veracruz in armed mule trains and loaded aboard the galleons of the New Spain fleet, which joined the Tierra Firma fleet in Havana, before sailing through the Straits of Florida and back to Cadiz. Filled with the treasures of Mexico, Peru, and the Orient, the Atlantic treasure fleets had always offered tempting targets for English buccaneers, privateers, and Royal Navy warships. The Manila galleons were another story. They were built to be impregnable, floating fortresses of 500 to 2,000 tons, bearing hundreds of men and tiers of heavy cannon. Only one Englishman had ever captured one, the buccaneer Thomas Cavendish in 1587, and that had been a relatively small 700-tonner. Dampier himself had attacked a Manila galleon during his last cruise, but in the words of one of his crewmen, "They were too hard for us." His ship's 5-pound cannonballs hardly made a dent in the treasure galleon's tropical hardwood hull, while the Spaniard's 24-pounders smashed into his ship's worm-infested hull. Nonetheless, in the words of another contemporary, Dampier never gave over the project and was eager to win young Rogers's support for his plan. Dampier was more desperate to leave England than Rogers could possibly have known. Despite his fame, his career was in shambles. His command of the HMS Roebuck had been a disaster. The 290-ton frigate sank on the way back to England, and when he and his marooned crew were finally rescued, Dampier faced 3 courts-martial. The court fined him his entire pay for the 3-year journey, ruling that Dampier is not a fit person to be employed as commander of any of Her Majesty's ships. On his Pacific privateering expedition, he quarreled with his officers, lost the respect of his crews, and in battle hid behind a barricade of beds and blankets he'd built on the quarterdeck. He'd failed to adequately clean the hulls of his ships, the 200-ton St. George and 90-ton galley Cinque Ports, leaving worms to devour them both. One crewman had even chosen to take his chances on an uninhabited Pacific island rather than continue aboard a decomposing vessel. In the end, the worms won and both ships went down, though not before a series of mutinies resulting in most of the crew abandoning their commodore. Dampier somehow made his way home, and faced a variety of lawsuits stemming from his poor command performance. Ignorant of much of this, Woods Rogers threw himself into Dampier's scheme, a privateering expedition to the Pacific to capture a Manila galleon. The main challenge was fundraising. From Dampier's experience, he knew taking on a Manila galleon would require at least two well-armed frigates, with enough men to allow for a sizable boarding party. Sending these ships to the Pacific would be expensive, far beyond what Rogers could bankroll. They would need an enormous store of food and supplies to sail that far from home, and a team of reliable and experienced officers who could maintain discipline on a journey lasting 3 or 4 years. Fortunately for Rogers, his well-connected father-in-law, Sir William Whetstone, had just arrived back in Bristol and was willing to present the bold plan to the city's leading merchants. They went for it, hook, line, and sinker. Mayors, former mayors, would-be mayors, sheriffs, town clerks, and the head of Bristol's all-powerful Society of Merchant Venturers all bought shares, as did Rogers's friend and possible relative, Francis Rogers. Together, these local luminaries agreed to purchase and equip 2 new frigates, already under construction in the dockyards of Bristol. The Duke was the larger of the two, a 350-ton ship with 36 guns. The Duchess, slightly smaller at 260 tons and 26 guns. Rogers invested in the ships and was appointed as both Commodore of the expedition and Captain of the Duke. Another investor, noble-born merchant Stephen Courtney, commanded the Duchess. Dampier was hired as the expedition's indispensable Pacific Ocean pilot. Other officers included Rogers's younger brother, John, and the Duchess's executive officer, Edward Cook, a Bristol merchant captain who had been attacked twice by French ships in the preceding year. One of the largest investors, Dr. Thomas Dover, also came along as the expedition's president, a position that allowed him considerable say over strategic decisions, such as where to sail and what to attack. An Oxford-educated physician, Dover had earned the nickname Dr. Quicksilver for his propensity to administer mercury to his patients to treat a wide range of illnesses. The owners made him chief medical officer and also captain of the Marines, with ultimate authority over military operations ashore, which was odd, given that he had neither military experience nor, as subsequent events would show, a knack for leadership. Rogers's expedition would make him famous among his contemporaries, but it has also provided historians with the only detailed account of life aboard an early 18th-century privateering vessel. Both Rogers and Cook kept detailed daily diaries of their experiences on the 3-year journey and published them as competing books shortly after their return. Together with other letters and documents, they not only afford a comprehensive picture of some of Rogers's formative command challenges, but also a sense of those faced by Thatch, Vane, and other privateersmen during the War of Spanish Succession. The expedition departed on August 1, 1708, the ships flying the new Union Jack ensign of Great Britain, a nation that had been created in 1707 with the union of England and Scotland. Rogers was forced to spend a month in Ireland, retrofitting the ships, stocking supplies, and recruiting crewmen. They left Ireland with a complement of 333, a third of whom were Irish, Danish, Dutch, or other foreigners. The expedition council met soon thereafter to discuss an important problem, a shortage of alcohol and cold-weather clothing for the frigid journey through the Drake Passage. Rogers argued that alcohol was the more important of the two, as good liquor to sailors is preferable to clothing. So the council resolved to stop at Madeira to stock up on the island's namesake wine. Along the way, a large number of the Duke's crew mutinied after Rogers refused to take a neutral Swedish ship as a prize, a decision that, in their view, deprived them of plunder. The Duke's officers broke out muskets and cutlasses and kept control of the quarterdeck throughout the night, and in the morning managed to seize the ringleaders. Many captains would have executed the mutineers, but Rogers knew terror was not always the best way to win the respect and loyalty of a crew. He had the leading rebels placed in irons and their top instigators soundly whipped and sent back to England on a passing ship. The others he let off with light punishments, fines, or reduced rations, and returned to duty. He even took the trouble to address the entire crew, explaining why it would be unwise to seize a neutral ship, which would probably result in legal proceedings against them. These actions broke the mutineers' resolve, though the atmosphere on the Duke remained tense for many days. Had the ship not had double the ordinary number of officers, Rogers noted in his diary, the mutiny might have succeeded. They spent December 1708 sailing down the Atlantic coast of South America, the weather turning colder as they moved south. Rogers set six tailors to work making the crew cold-weather clothing from blankets, trade cloth, and the officers' hand-me-downs. The winds strengthened as they passed into the latitudes known as the Roaring Forties, and great waves swamped the decks of the smaller Dutchess. At times the ships were surrounded by breaching whales or great troops of exuberant dolphins, which, Rogers wrote, often leaped a good height out of the water, turning their white bellies uppermost. There were large numbers of seals, the occasional penguin, and soaring albatross. By January 5, 1709, the ships had entered the Southern Ocean, and the seas grew to 30 feet or more, lifting the ship so quickly that the men could feel the blood swelling their feet, and then dropping them into the trough so fast they felt almost weightless. As the wind speeds increased, the captain sent men up into the rigging to lower the upper sails and reef the lower ones, to prevent them from being torn to shreds. Suddenly, there was a terrible mishap aboard the Dutchess. As the men lowered the main yard, the crosswise timber suspending the main sail, one side slipped, dropping part of the big sail into the water. At the speed the Dutchess was moving, the sail acted like a gigantic anchor, pulling the port side down so far that the frigid, gray ocean began pouring onto the main deck. Captain Courtney ordered the other sails loosened. The Dutchess swung into the wind, sails flapping like flags, her bow facing into the towering seas. "We expected the ship would sink every moment," Edward Cook recounted, "floundered with the weight of the water that was in her." The crew secured the mainsail. Courtney swung her around, stern to the screaming wind. The vessel began drifting rapidly to the south, toward the still undiscovered continent of Antarctica. Rogers, watching these events from the Duke, became increasingly worried as he followed the Dutchess further and further toward the bergs and pack ice Dampier had warned lay in these southern waters. At 9 p.m., the spring sun still high above the horizon, the Dutchess's exhausted officers went down to the great cabin for dinner. Just before their food was served, a massive wave crashed into her stern, smashing through the windows and carrying everything it picked up, human and otherwise, forward through the ship. Edward Cook was certain all of them would have drowned in the submerged cabin had its interior wall not been torn down by the force of the wave. An officer's sword was found driven straight through the hammock belonging to Cook's servant, who fortunately was not in it at the time. Amazingly, only two men were injured, but the entire middle of the ship was filled with water, soaking every bit of clothing, bedding, and cargo in ice-cold seawater. Somehow, the Dutchess stayed afloat through the night, during which time the storm abated. In the morning, Rogers and Dampier rowed over from the Duke and found the crew in a very orderly pickle. busying themselves with pumping water from the hold and lowering some of the heavy cannon into storage to make the ship less top-heavy. Her masts and rigging were covered in wet clothes, bedding, and hammocks hung out to dry in the icy wind. The captains agreed that the two ships had been pushed to nearly 62 degrees south, almost to Antarctica, slightly shy of the farthest point south any person had yet been known to travel. By the end of the day, they had swung around to the northwest and beat their way toward the Pacific in the mouth of yet another Drake Passage gale. As they crawled out of the Antarctic toward the warmth of the southern spring, the crew began to fall sick. Some suffered from exposure after spending days in soaked or frozen clothing. Others were stricken with scurvy, the disease mariners feared more than any other. An affliction caused by a lack of vitamin C, scurvy is thought to have carried off more mariners in the age of sail than all other causes combined. Without vitamin C, the sailors' bodies could no longer maintain connective tissues, causing gums to turn black and spongy, teeth to fall out, and bruises to form beneath scaly skin. Toward the end, as the sailors withered and wheezed in their hammocks, bones broken long before became unhealed, and old scars opened into wounds again. Most mariners believed it was caused by exposure to cold and damp clothing, but Rogers and Dover were aware it had more to do with a lack of fresh fruit and vegetables on long ocean passages. At a time when the Royal Navy had no treatment for the disease, Rogers stocked his ships with limes, which were rich in vitamin C. This supply was now exhausted, so the ships were in a race against time to get fresh produce. The first man, John Veal of the Duke, died on January 7th and was buried at sea in the Drake Passage. From his prior travels, Dampier knew of a sanctuary where they would find ample provisions without alerting the Spaniards of Chile to their presence. The uninhabited island of Juan Fernandez, 400 miles off the coast, renamed Robinson Crusoe Island in 1966 by the Chilean government. By the time the jagged peaks of Juan Fernandez were sighted on January 31st, more than 30 men were sick, and 7 men had perished. There, to their surprise, they saw a fire on the shore, an indication that a Spanish vessel was visiting the remote island. The next morning, the Duke and Duchess sailed into the harbor entrance, their guns ready for action. It was deserted. Rogers anchored the ships a mile from shore, while Dr. Dover, eager to secure provisions, led a landing party ashore in one of the ship's boats. As they approached the beach, they were shocked to see a solitary man, clad in goatskin, waving a white cloth, and yelling exuberantly to them in English. Alexander Selkirk, the castaway whose story would inspire Daniel Defoe to write Robinson Crusoe, was about to be rescued. Selkirk had been stranded on Juan Fernandez Island for 4 years and 4 months. Indeed, ever since William Dampier's ill-fated privateering mission had passed through these parts in the latter part of 1704. Selkirk, a Scotsman, had been the mate aboard Dampier's consort, the Cinque Ports, whose captain and officers had lost faith in their commodore's leadership and sailed off on their own. Unfortunately, the Cinque Ports' hull was already infested by shipworm, so much so that when the galley stopped at Juan Fernandez for water and fresh provisions, young Selkirk decided to stay, to take his chances on the island rather than try to cross the Pacific in a deteriorating vessel. According to the extended account he gave Rogers, Selkirk spent the better part of a year in deep despair, scanning the horizon for friendly vessels that never appeared. Slowly, he adapted to his solitary world. The island was home to hundreds of goats, descendants of those left behind when the Spanish abandoned a half-hearted colonization attempt. He eventually learned to chase them down and catch them with his bare hands. He built 2 huts with goatskin walls and grass roofs, one serving as a kitchen, the other as his living quarters, where he read the Bible, sang psalms, and fought off the armies of rats that came to nibble his toes as he slept. He defeated the rodents by feeding and befriending many of the island's feral cats, which lay about his hut by the hundreds. As insurance against starvation in case of accident or illness, Selkirk had managed to domesticate a number of goats, which he raised by hand and on occasion would dance with in his lonely hut. When his clothes wore out, he stitched together new goatskin ones, using a knife and an old nail, and grew calluses on his feet as a substitute for shoes. He was rarely sick, and ate a healthful diet of turnips, goats, crayfish, and wild cabbage. He'd barely evaded a Spanish landing party by hiding at the top of a tree, against which some of his pursuers pissed, unaware of his presence. Although Selkirk greeted Rogers' men with enthusiasm, he was reluctant to join them after learning that his old commodore, William Dampier, was serving with them. Cook wrote that Selkirk distrusted Dampier so much that he would rather have chosen to remain in his solitude than come away with Dampier, till informed that he did not command the expedition. Dr. Dover and his landing party were only able to rescue the castaway by promising they would return him to the island were he not satisfied with the situation. Selkirk, in turn, helped them catch crayfish, piling them into the ship's boat before they rowed him out to the Duke. On seeing Selkirk for the first time, Roger said he looked wilder than the original owners of his goatskin coverings. At his first coming on board us, he had so much forgot his language for want of use that we could scarce understand him, for he seemed to speak by halves, Rogers wrote in his journal. We offered him a dram, but he would not touch it, having drank nothing but water since his being there, and 'twas some time before he could relish our victuals. Selkirk was remarkably healthy and alert at first, but Rogers noted that this man, when he came to our ordinary method of diet and life, though he was sober enough, lost much of his strength and agility. The expedition stayed on the island for 12 days. A tent city was set up on shore, and there the sick men were nursed to health with turnip greens and Selkirk's special goat broth. Only 2 of the 50 patients died. Rogers lived in a tent on the beach, overseeing the repair of rigging, barrels, and sails. Selkirk ran down 3 or 4 goats each day, while the officers shot some of the seals and sea lions that lolled about on the shore by the thousands. The men who worked ashore on the rigging eat young seals, which they preferred to our ship's victuals, and said was as good as English lamb, Rogers wrote, though for my own part, I should have been glad of such an exchange. Selkirk decided he enjoyed the company of men and joined the expedition as mate. On the 13th of February, he helped load the last firewood, water barrels, and freshly salted fish on board, and bid farewell to his island home. The next month proved frustrating. The privateers prowled the coast of Peru under an intense sun for weeks on end without seeing a single vessel. Rogers became increasingly concerned about the crew's darkening temperament. It didn't help that some men were showing renewed signs of scurvy, or that one of the Duchess's boys whimpered in his hammock, having broken his leg in a fall from the mizzenmast. Rogers's lookouts didn't sight a sail until the afternoon of March 16th. It proved a pathetic prize, a 16-ton coastal trading bark carrying 50 pounds, a 7-man crew, and 8 black and Incan slaves. Rogers's prize crew took over the vessel, to which he gave the hopeful name, Beginning. After that, the prizes finally started coming in. Based out of the desolate, guano-covered Lobos Islands, 30 miles off the Peruvian coast, Rogers's ships captured 4 Spanish vessels, one of them a 500-ton ship carrying a cargo familiar to Rogers, slaves. There were 73 of them, mostly women and children, whose names were later added to the expedition's account ledgers, carefully sorted by gender and categories, from the 2 useful men, mariners Jacob and Quashy, to 2 infant girls, Teresia and Molly. Amid the stink of Lobos, Rogers now presided over a sizable flotilla and a growing army of prisoners and slaves, all taken without a shot. With some 200 captives to provide for, the expedition's water supply was vanishing fast, and Rogers realized they would have to make a trip to the mainland. The privateers held an official council and agreed that if they had to betray their presence, they might as well surprise attack a wealthy town at the same time. They chose the shipbuilding port of Guayaquil in today's Ecuador, which Dampier had sacked as a buccaneer in 1684. En route, however, they gave chase to a large French ship, and in the ensuing battle, Woods's brother, John, took a musket ball to the head and died, an event that Rogers took with unspeakable sorrow. The only consolation was that the prize, the French-built Havre de Grace, carried a considerable quantity of pearls, 74 slaves, and a number of wealthy Spanish passengers, improving his crew's morale. The siege of Guayaquil was a comedy of errors. Under cover of darkness, the invaders paddled up the Guaya River in the boats while the ships remained outside its mouth. Rogers, Dover, and Courtney each led a detachment of 65 men, but Dover, as captain of the Marines, was the overall commander. It took 2 nights to reach the city, the intervening day spent hiding among mosquito-infested mangroves. On approaching the city, they mistook a festive celebration for the cheers of a defending army. Rogers counseled an immediate attack, but Dover preferred to spend another day hiding in the mangroves. The next evening, Dover insisted on negotiating with the Spanish, thereby losing the element of surprise altogether. The governor of Guayaquil, Don Jeronimo Bosa y Solis y Pacheco, dithered for days over the payment of a ransom, while his staff evacuated some 100,000 pounds in valuables out of the area. Finally, Rogers, disgusted with both the doctor and the governor, usurped command and launched an assault on the city. He captured it with a loss of only 2 men. As most of Guayaquil's valuables had been spirited away, the privateers found only bulky goods and barrels of alcohol. Many of the men got drunk, and in their search for plunder started digging up corpses in the churchyard, unaware that Guayaquil had recently been stricken by bubonic plague. While the sailors rifled through the corpses, exposing themselves to the Black Death, Rogers and his officers enjoyed a dinner hosted by Don Jeronimo, who eventually ransomed his city for 26,810 pesos, 6,703 pounds, a fraction of what a more timely assault might have captured. Any celebration of the assault's success was short-lived. On May 10, 1709, 2 days out to sea, Rogers's men began falling sick by the dozens. Within a week, 140 men were down with the plague and 2 had died. The fleet had trouble finding water on the rocky islands they stopped at, and the crew of one of the prize ships barely staved off a slave uprising. By June 14th, when they reached the island sanctuary of Gorgona, part of modern Colombia, both Rogers and Courtney were sick, and 6 men had died. They spent 6 weeks recovering at Gorgona, during which time the crews cleaned and repaired the ships and fitted the Havre de Grace with new masts, rigging, and weapons, while the officers ransomed off some of the prize ships to their captains. A number of slaves were sold to local merchants who came by in canoes, and 2 black boys were given to Cook and another officer as rewards for their bravery in attacking the Havre de Grace. an unlucky black girl was turned over to a lecherous Spanish priest, a reward for having helped the privateers trade goods. Rogers wrote that he was sure the priest will crack a commandment with her and wipe off the sin with the church's indulgence. Most of the plague-ridden men recovered in tents ashore, but the morale of the crew did not improve. Indeed, the men believed that Rogers and the officers were cheating them. 60 of them signed a document attesting that they would stop work unless the plunder were more equitably divided. Imbued by Henry Avery, perhaps, they didn't feel that Rogers should get 14 shares to an ordinary seaman's one. Rogers and Courtney had already surrendered their customary right to all plunder found in the captain's cabins of prize vessels, which Rogers reckoned had slashed their personal take by 90%. Now they were forced to further increase the crew's portion of the take. To make matters worse, the officers were still quarreling over who should have done what at Guayaquil. Tensions mounted to the point where Rogers felt compelled to have them swear an oath on the Bible that each would come to the aid of the other in case of battle. Under these uneasy truces, the privateers left Gorgona in early August 1709, and by early November were off the coast of Baja California, awaiting the arrival of the Manila galleons. Weeks passed. Water and supplies dwindled, and the officers worried they wouldn't have enough to make the 7,000-mile run to Guam. Riddled with shipworm, the Duke and Havre de Grace were leaking, and each passing day made them less likely to survive the long Pacific crossing. On December 20th, the officers decided to call it quits and head home, while they still could. "We all looked very melancholy and dispirited," Rogers wrote in his journal. As the ships prepared for their departure, a sail appeared on the western horizon, large, multi-masted, and coming from the direction of far-off Manila. The men worked all night preparing the Duke and Duchess for action as they sailed through the darkness in the direction of the galleon. Daybreak found the Spanish ship to be just 3 miles off the Duke's bow. The Duchess had overshot her prey in the dark and would have to tack a mile back to her. Looking over the Spanish vessel, Rogers realized that the Duke might be able to take her alone. The Nuestra Señora de la Encarnación Desengaño was not a typical galleon, but rather a lumbering ship-rigged vessel of 450 tons and 20 guns. Rogers had a tub of hot chocolate set out on deck for the men, and with this comforting beverage in hand, the crew said their prayers as the first of the Encarnación's cannonballs splashed into the water. Rogers ordered the Duke alongside the Spanish vessel and gave the command to fire. His ship rocked as the guns discharged one after another. The muzzles of the Encarnación's cannon flared in response. A musket ball tore into Rogers's left cheek, splattering much of his upper jaw and a number of his teeth on the deck. As he lay in a growing pool of blood, he could see the enemy's raised forecastle passing along the length of his rail. He tried to bark out an order, but the pain was too excruciating, so he scribbled a command on a scrap of paper. Accordingly, the Duke turned sharply, passed ahead of the Encarnación's bowsprit, and discharged her guns to deadly effect. The Encarnación's French-born captain, Jean Picheperty, struck his colors, and the English clambered aboard their greatest prize. Captain Picheperty provided his captors with a fascinating piece of information. 2 treasure ships had left Manila that year, and the Encarnación was by far the smaller of them. The other, the Nuestra Señora de Begonia, was a proper treasure galleon, a mighty vessel of 900 tons with twin gun decks and a vast store of Oriental luxuries. Rogers issued further written orders for the fleet to escort the Encarnación into the secluded Baja Harbor they had been using as a base, and for the officers to prepare to intercept the Begonia. He then retreated to his cabin, his face and throat grotesquely swollen, barely able to drink. He was not yet aware that a Spanish musket ball was lodged deeply in the roof of his mouth. His colleagues tried to persuade Rogers to stay aboard the Encarnacion while they sailed off to find the Begonia, but he refused to leave the Duke. The crew of the Duke was still repairing the ship from its battle with the Encarnacion on Christmas Day when the Begonia appeared on the horizon. By the time Rogers got the Duke out of the harbor that evening, the Duchess and Havre de Grace were already miles out to sea, closing in on the enormous galleon. All night long he watched the flashes of ships' cannons exchanging broadsides. In the morning he could see that the Duchess had been hard hit, her masts damaged and rigging in disorder. That afternoon, Rogers watched the Duchess and Havre de Grace engage the galleon for hours, only to retreat again. The Duke didn't catch up to the running battle until late afternoon on the 27th, at which point all three privateers circled the Begonia, bombarding her with cannon fire. In the action, a wood splinter tore through Rogers's left foot, leaving his heel bone sticking out and half of his ankle missing. Cook, commanding the Havre de Grace, estimated the fleet had unloaded 300 cannonballs and 50 rounds of sail-wrecking barshot on the Begonia, but their 6-pound cannon had little effect on her thick, rock-hard hull. "We might as well have fought a castle of 50 guns as this ship," Cook lamented. The Begonia's heavy cannon blasted the English ships, punching holes in their hulls and killing or wounding 33. Running low on ammunition, the privateers had to admit they were outmatched and abandoned the Begonia to continue her run to Acapulco. Rogers, unable to speak or walk, prepared the fleet for the long trip home. It took another 22 months to reach England, during which time relations between the officers deteriorated. They fought over who would take command of the Encarnacion, whose holds were packed with silk, spices, jewels, silver, and other finery, later found to be worth over £100,000. Amazingly, Courtney and Cook were willing to allow Dr. Dover to command the ship. Still in unbearable pain, Rogers mustered the other officers to block the appointment, declaring Dover utterly incapable of the office. In the paper war that followed, the officers agreed to a compromise, whereby Selkirk and others would actually operate the Encarnacion, while Dover held the ceremonial title of Chief Captain. The skirmish made Rogers some bitter enemies. In late June 1710, they arrived at the Dutch East Indies capital of Batavia, now Jakarta, Indonesia, the first friendly port they'd seen in a year and a half. There they cleaned the weakening hulls of the Duke, Duchess, and Encarnacion, and sold the now worm-eaten Havre de Grace for scrap. Courtney and some of the other officers in Dover's faction would later claim that the Duke was still dangerously leaky and in need of a new keel, and that Rogers had refused to address the problem. They also suspected that Rogers had insidious designs to sail to Newfoundland or Brazil and trade in contraband East Indian goods. This was a serious allegation, for the British East India Company had a legal monopoly over all British trade with Southeast Asia. Crossing the powerful East India Company, they noted, may end damage the expedition. Many in the crew came to believe Rogers had stolen a large quantity of treasure and hid it at Batavia, though this seems both improbable and out of character. We do know that during his 6-month stay at Batavia, he underwent surgery to repair his heel and remove the musket ball from the roof of his mouth. He also closely supervised the purchase of necessities for the trip home to avoid any entanglements with the East India Company, though even these precautions didn't save the Bristol men from the insatiable greed of the company's directors. When the three ships finally dropped anchor in the Thames on October 14, 1711, the East India Company's agents were waiting for them. The privateers' purchase of provisions at Batavia, they argued, constituted a violation of the company's monopoly. They seized the great Acapulco ship, already made famous by the London newspapers, and embroiled the privateer's owners in a lengthy legal dispute. In the end, over 6,000 pounds of the 147,975 pounds in proceeds was paid to the company's directors. Once expenses were deducted, each of the owners had doubled his investment. Rogers, his face mutilated, his foot mangled, his brother dead, received about 1,600 pounds, much of which was probably consumed by his family's debts back in Bristol. Many of the crew received nothing at all, having been pressed aboard Royal Navy ships as soon as the Duke and Duchess reached London. Rogers returned to his wife and children in Bristol to mend his wounds and prepare his journal for publication. His circumnavigation and successful capture of a Manila ship had made him a national hero, but it had also left him maimed, aggrieved, and little wealthier than the day he'd left home 3 years earlier. Rogers wasn't the only one recovering from trauma in the late summer of 1712. Across the Atlantic in Jamaica, Edward Thatch and Charles Vane had been witnesses to far worse. On August 28, 1712, Jamaica was struck by one of the most powerful hurricanes in its history. Of Charles Vane, we know three things. During the War of Spanish Succession, he came to reside in Port Royal. He was a professional mariner, and he was acquainted with the soon-to-be-infamous Captain Henry Jennings. When the winds suddenly shifted from north to south on the fateful August night, Vane may well have been aboard Captain Jennings's four-gun sloop Diamond, which was anchored among hundreds of other ships in Port Royal's harbor. The harbor this evening was particularly crowded due to an embargo on shipping. A French attack was deemed imminent. Because of this, Edward Thatch was probably there as well, resting ashore at Port Royal. Also in Port Royal was the London slave ship captain Lawrence Prince and the Massachusetts merchant master William Wire, both of whom would one day run afoul of the pirates. Jennings, an established Jamaican merchant captain of good standing and estate, commanded a vessel with empty holds, whatever cargo she'd been carrying having long since been unloaded during the island's weeks-long embargo. The storm struck around 8 at night, a furious hurricane of lightning, wind, and rain without thunder. It blew down trees, flattened homes and warehouses, toppled sugar works, and tore apart entire fields of sugarcane. A number of people ashore lost their lives when their houses, the hospital, and half of Kingston's main church collapsed, but the greatest carnage took place out in the harbor. At least 54 vessels sank, capsized, or were driven ashore, including the sloop of war HMS Jamaica and the slaver Joseph Galley, which lost every member of her crew and all 107 slaves chained in her hold. Captain Wire was on land when the storm sank his slaver, the Anne Galley, drowning 100 slaves and half of his 28 crewmen. Lawrence Prince lost the vessel under his command, the brigantine Adventure, as did Henry Jennings, though neither lost any men. When the sun came up the next morning, it revealed beaches and salt marshes strewn with smashed and dismasted vessels and dozens of corpses. In addition to the slaves, an estimated 400 sailors had lost their lives. As Jennings, Vane, Thatch, and other mariners took stock of the destruction in the following weeks, a ship arrived bearing dramatic news from Europe. Queen Anne had declared a cessation of hostilities with France and Spain. The war was coming to an end, and with it, the stream of wealth and plunder brought to Jamaica by the privateering trade. With much of the Jamaican merchant fleet lying wrecked on the shores, hundreds of seamen were out of work, left to fend for themselves amid the wreckage of Kingston and Port Royal. Ironically, another hurricane would bring them riches on a scale the wartime privateers could have only dreamed of. Chapter 4. Peace, 1713 to 1715. With the end of the War of the Spanish Succession in 1713, tens of thousands of sailors suddenly found themselves out of a job. The Royal Navy, bankrupted by the 12-year-long World War, rapidly demobilized, mothballing ships and dumping nearly three-quarters of its manpower, over 36,000 men, in the first 24 months following the signing of the Peace of Utrecht. Privateering commissions ceased to have any value, their owners compelled to tie their warships up and turn the crews out onto the wharves of England and the Americas. With thousands of sailors begging for work in every port, merchant captains slashed wages by 50%. Those lucky enough to find work had to survive on 22 to 28 shillings, 1.1 to 1.4 pounds a month. Peace did not bring safety to those English sailors who found work in the West Indies. Spanish Coast Guard vessels, the Guardas Costas, continued to seize English vessels passing to and from Jamaica, declaring them smugglers if so much as a single Spanish coin were found aboard. They always found the illicit coins because they were the de facto currency of all of England's Caribbean colonies. 38 Jamaican vessels were so seized in the first 2 years of peace, costing the vessel owners nearly £76,000. When the crews resisted, the Guardas Costas often killed a few in retribution. The rest spent months or years in Cuban prisons. The seas, the governor of Jamaica would later recall, had become more dangerous than in time of war. As the months passed, the streets, taverns, and boarding houses of Port Royal grew crowded with angry, destitute mariners. Merchants, stung by their losses, sent out fewer vessels, further reducing the number of jobs for sailors. Those sailors who had been captured, some more than once, were physically abused by the Spanish and financially pinched by their employers, who reduced their losses by not paying them for the time they were serving in prison. Resentment and the want of employ, one resident later recalled, were certainly the motives to a course of life which I am of the opinion that most or many of them would not have taken up had they been redressed or could by any lawful mean have supported themselves. Benjamin Hornigold was one of the very first to turn to this other course of life, and he took Edward Thatch with him. They had both served aboard Jamaican privateers during the war, and now found themselves stuck in Port Royal Harbor. By the summer of 1713, they had had enough of poverty and the Spanish Coast Guard. Hornigold suggested to a number of former shipmates and drinking buddies that they put their skills together to solve both problems. They should go back to attacking Spanish shipping, avenging and enriching themselves at the same time. All they needed was a small vessel, a few good men, and a secure nest from which to launch their raids. Hornigold knew just the place. The Bahamas, every Jamaican knew, was a perfect buccaneering base. The western end of the 700-island archipelago stood alongside the Straits of Florida, the primary shipping channel for every Europe-bound vessel in South America, Mexico, and the Greater Antilles, including Spanish Cuba, English Jamaica, and the new French colony on the island of Hispaniola. Sailing vessels had little choice but to pass this way in order to reach the colonies of the eastern seaboard or to catch the trade winds back to Europe. Pirates could hide among the maze of islands, taking advantage of 100 little known anchorages where water and fresh fruit could be collected, vessels careened and repaired, and plunder safely divided. Nobody would have dared to follow them into the tight channels between those islands without an experienced Bahamian pilot aboard. With hundreds of low, sandy scraps of land, one could easily become lost and subject their craft to sharp reefs and uncharted shoals. More importantly, since attacking the Spaniards was technically against the law, the Bahamas didn't have a government, and hadn't since the Franco-Spanish invasion of July 1703. Thus, late in that first peacetime summer of 1713, Hornigold and a small band of followers left Port Royal and sailed 450 miles north, passing between Cuba and Hispaniola and into the coral-studded labyrinth of the Bahamas. During the war, the Spanish and French sacked New Providence Island 4 times, burning Nassau to the ground, spiking the fort's guns, carrying off the governor as well as most of the island's African slaves, and forcing the rest of the population into the woods. In the aftermath, most survivors abandoned the island, leaving only a handful of settlers who, according to resident John Graves, lived scatteringly in little huts, ready upon any assault to secure themselves in the woods. When word of the first raid got back to London, the aristocrats who owned the Bahamas appointed a new governor, Edward Birch, and sent him across the Atlantic to re-establish order in the backwater colony. When Birch arrived in January 1704, he found New Providence almost completely deserted, and according to contemporary historian John Oldmixon, did not give himself the trouble to open his commission. Birch tarried for 3 or 4 months, sleeping in the woods, before leaving his government to its own devices. 9 years later, little had changed. When Hornigold and his companions stepped onto the beach at Nassau, they found not a town, but a collection of partially collapsed buildings, overgrown with scrub and tropical vegetation, gathered around the burned-out shells of a church and fort that Nicholas Trott had constructed a quarter century earlier. On the whole island, there were probably fewer than 30 families living in hovels and rudimentary houses, eking out a living by catching fish, cutting trees, or picking the bones of ships unfortunate enough to wreck on the island's treacherous shores. Hornigold took a good look around and realized he'd made the right choice. It began humbly enough. Hornigold and his men built or acquired 3 large wooden boats called periaguas, or canoes, capable of carrying 30 men and an ample supply of cargo. Equipped with banks of oars and a single fore and aft rigged sail, they were well suited to small-scale piracy. Swift, able to row straight into the wind to catch or escape from a square-rigged vessel, and drawing so little water, they could be rowed or sailed over shoals, coral heads, and other hazards to give would-be pursuers the slip. Armed with cutlasses, muskets, pikes, and cudgels, Hornigold's men could count on easily overwhelming a lightly crewed trading sloop or the overseers of a remote Spanish or French plantation. Cuba lay just 175 miles to the south, Spanish Florida 160 miles west, and French Hispaniola 400 miles to the southeast. The little pirate gang was perfectly poised to descend on their wartime enemies. The men organized themselves into 3 bands, each with 25 men and a canoe. Hornigold led one, and John West, about whom little is known, and John Cockrum, an ambitious young mariner with a head for trade, led the others. Over the next 6 months, they attacked small Spanish trading vessels and isolated sugar plantations from the Straits of Florida to the shores of Cuba. Hornigold's band returned to Nassau laden with bales of expensive linens from Silesia and Prussia. Cockrum brought back Asian silks, copper, rum, sugar, and silver coins stolen from Spanish vessels off Florida and elsewhere. West came home with 14 African slaves, stolen from a Cuban plantation. Together, they brought cargoes worth 13,175 pounds into the ruins of Nassau, 10 times the value of the annual imports of the entire colony of Bermuda. The fledgling pirate gangs needed someone to sell these stolen goods to, preferably without undertaking the long journey to Jamaica, where officials might demand a share under threat of legal entanglements. Fortunately, they appear to have found ready buyers among the relatively stable settlers of Harbor Island, 50 miles north of Nassau, which had a population of about 200. Richard Thompson, the island's largest and wealthiest landowner and merchant, had no scruples about fencing the Nassau pirates' goods and little sympathy for the Spanish, who had done Bahamians so much harm. He and John Cockrum seemed to have hit it off particularly well. In fact, by March 1714, Cockrum had married one of Thompson's daughters and was living contentedly with her on Eleuthera, Harbor Island's larger, less developed neighbor. Thompson even made his new son-in-law master of one of his trading sloops, sending him on smuggling runs to the Dutch spice island of Curaçao, 1,000 miles away, with loads of braceletto wood, from which a valuable red dye could be extracted. Thompson presumably purchased most of the pirates' cargo. It wouldn't be long before he and Cockrum would emerge as the leading black market traders of the golden age of piracy. By late winter 1714, rumors began circulating on New Providence that Spanish authorities in Havana were preparing a retaliatory raid on the island. The pirates consulted with one another and decided to divide their plunder, now 60,000 pounds worth, and split up. West and many of the rank-and-file pirates apparently chose to quit while they were ahead and scattered off to Jamaica and beyond. A handful stayed on in the Bahamas, including Hornigold, who joined John Cockrum and others in the relative safety of Harbor Island, with its snug, easily defended harbor and battery of cannon. Edward Thatch was very likely among them, laying low and waiting for the Spaniards' anger to subside. The Peace of Utrecht had also put Sam Bellamy out of work. According to 300 years of oral history, he made his way to Eastham, Massachusetts, located on the outermost reaches of Cape Cod, in 1714 or early 1715. There's no documentary evidence to confirm their stories, though the people of the Outer Cape have been telling them in more or less the same form since the days of the great pirates. Nor is there any proof to the contrary. In fact, the evidence we do have fits the Cape legend tantalizingly well. Families who were living in and around Eastham had close ties with the English West Country, where Bellamy is believed to have been from, and some had surnames and pedigrees that suggest they might have been his mother's kinsmen. Most importantly, the primary character in the legend, the figure on which the story turns, was in fact a real person whose life details are consistent with the folk traditions of the Cape.
This audiobook is continued on Disc 4.